Autoridades presentes, señoras y señores, muy buenos días. Damos la bienvenida a la conferencia Derechos Humanos y Orden Social, Dimensiones Filosóficas, Prácticas y de Política Pública. El día de hoy tenemos el honor de contar con la presencia del señor Matías Rice, profesor de Filosofía y Administración Pública de Harvard y director del Carl Center for Human Rights Policy del John F. Kennedy School of Government de la misma universidad. Queremos agradecer a todos su presencia esta mañana y saludamos especialmente a las autoridades que hoy nos acompañan. Al rector de la Pontificia Universidad Católica de Chile, señor Ignacio Sánchez. Al conferencista esta mañana, señor Matías Rice. A la defensora de la niñez, señora Patricia Muñoz. Al prorector de gestión institucional, señor Patricio Donoso. Y al director del Centro de Políticas Públicas UC, señor Ignacio Irarrázaval. Saludamos también a quienes conformarán el panel de conversación. Señor Eduardo Valenzuela, decano de la Facultad de Ciencias Sociales de la Universidad Católica. Señora Ana María Stuben, académica del Instituto de Investigación en Ciencias Sociales de la Universidad Diego Portales. Y saludamos también a los señores decanos, autoridades universitarias, representantes del sector público, representantes de fuerzas de orden y seguridad, académicos e investigadores. Para dar inicio a este encuentro, invitamos al rector de la Pontificia Universidad Católica de Chile, señor Ignacio Sánchez, a dar unas palabras.
Muy buenos días y muchas gracias por estar aquí. Dear Matías, and thank you so much for your presence, your commitment with our university and also with the country. Quisiera saludar a Patricia Muñoz, defensora de la niñez. Hemos estado en conversaciones para poder desde la Universidad Católica trabajar muy unidamente a la Defensoría de la Niñez. Creo que es una posibilidad muy importante. Saludar a todas las autoridades de la universidad, a los panelistas que hoy día se han congregado y a todos quienes vienen hoy día a participar de esta conferencia y particularmente de este panel. Reciban todos ustedes una cordial bienvenida. Agradezco su presencia esta mañana, de manera especial a Matías Rice, como se ha dicho, director del Carl Center for Human Rights Policy de la Escuela de Gobierno de Harvard, y a los panelistas invitados. En primer término, a la profesora Ana María Stuben, quien es profesora de nuestro Instituto de Historia, académica del Instituto de Investigación de Ciencias Sociales de la Universidad Diego Portales, y al profesor y decano Eduardo Valenzuela, de la Facultad de Ciencias Sociales, quienes van a compartir junto a Ignacio Irarrázaval y al profesor Rice en el panel. Ayer, 18 de octubre, se cumplieron 2 meses del estallido social que ha marcado un hito prácticamente sin precedentes en nuestro país, al menos desde el advenimiento de la democracia. Chile despertó, es el lema ciudadano, y representa el sentir de una gran mayoría de chilenos y chilenas que han exigido un país más justo y equitativo, que pide reformas serias a un modelo de desarrollo que debe estar al servicio de la dignidad y del desarrollo de las personas. Sin lugar a dudas, desde esa fecha se han dado pasos importantes a nivel del Parlamento, a nivel de la discusión pública, de la escucha, y quizás el más evidente es el acuerdo en que en abril próximo podamos votar si queremos o no una nueva constitución y bajo qué mecanismos se realizaría. Sin embargo, el costo que hemos tenido que pagar ha sido muy alto y aún queda mucho por avanzar para reconstruir el tejido social y particularmente las confianzas de la sociedad. En las últimas semanas hemos conocido varios informes de instituciones serias y prestigiosas internacionales y nacionales que confirman violaciones a derechos humanos por parte de policía y carabineros, tanto en manifestaciones con el uso de perdigones y balines, como también en detenciones en las que se ha hecho uso desmedido de la fuerza y se han cometido condenables abusos. Desde el principio hemos condenado estos abusos y también hemos apoyado a carabineros en la restitución del orden público. Creo que aquí no hay un blanco y negro, sino que hay situaciones que se enmarcan en acciones al interior de policía y carabineros que escapan al respeto a los derechos humanos, y también hay acciones de violencia inusitada contra la fuerza policial, que ha hecho que más de un centenar de efectivos policiales tengan serios daños a su salud. Las marchas pacíficas y la movilización social que ha levantado la voz frente a la injusticia social de nuestro país se han enturbiado por la acción de grupos minoritarios constituidos por anarquistas y delincuentes que no tienen otro horizonte que la destrucción, lo que está impactando seriamente la vida de muchas personas, particularmente los más vulnerables, los pequeños comerciantes, la gente de trabajo, la gente que quiere cuidar a su familia y que en lugares vulnerables sufre del miedo y del desamparo. Todo y cada uno de estos abusos deben ser investigados a fondo, no pueden volver a repetirse, y toda esta violencia debe ser condenada por toda la sociedad. Los chilenos tenemos un capítulo en nuestra historia muy triste de violación a los derechos humanos, lo que no puede repetirse en democracia. Solo podremos alcanzar la paz social si respetamos el valor central de la persona y su dignidad, y este es el nuevo acuerdo social que debemos construir. Sin lugar a dudas, la violencia ha disminuido en las últimas semanas, sin embargo, aún queda afectando a miles de ciudadanos. Y sin ir más lejos, anoche, alrededor de esta zona, hubo nuevamente brotes de descontrol, violencia, por parte de grupos muy minoritarios. Como Universidad Católica queremos ser hoy más que nunca un espacio de encuentro y de reflexión, y asumiendo a la vez una posición enérgica de rechazo tanto a la violación a los derechos humanos como al vandalismo y a la delincuencia. Nuestro punto de partida fue la realización de dos grandes encuentros con la participación de toda la comunidad universitaria, en que cerca de 1,000 miembros de la universidad se reunieron para trabajar en un diagnóstico que daría lugar a propuestas futuras y particularmente a líneas de trabajo. Junto con esto, hace un par de semanas realizamos el seminario Orden Público y Derechos Humanos, en que académicos y analistas debatieron sobre la tensión entre el restablecimiento del orden público y el respeto irrestricto a los derechos humanos. Estas dos actividades se suman a, yo diría, más de una decena de actividades que han hecho las distintas facultades y unidades académicas, en la reflexión de la Constitución, en el orden social, en la nueva ley para ISAPRES, en la nueva ley para las pensiones, etcétera, etcétera. En esa línea, y porque sentimos el deber de seguir reflexionando e impulsando el diálogo en estas materias, hoy contaremos con la charla magistral del profesor de Harvard, Matías Ruise, quien viajó especialmente desde Massachusetts para estar aquí con nosotros. El profesor Ruise tiene un currículum muy espectacular. Quisiera decir que él es magíster en matemáticas, doctor en filosofía por Princeton, experto en administración pública y, como he dicho, director del Carl Center for Human Rights Policy del John Kennedy School of Government. Un centro que tiene por misión lograr la justicia global a través de la teoría, la política y la práctica, para lo cual trabajan en cuatro áreas específicas. Uno, seguridad humana. Dos, justicia económica. Tres, gobierno global e igualdad. Y discriminación. En particular, el trabajo del profesor Ruise aborda principalmente cuestiones de justicia global que van desde los derechos humanos, la desigualdad y la inmigración, hasta el cambio climático y el futuro de la tecnología. Él ha explorado, entre otros temas, los desafíos en materia de derechos humanos que se enmarcarán en la creciente inteligencia artificial. Y es autor de varios libros. Solamente describo Justicia Global, Filosofía Política Global, y por último, On Trade Justice, una mirada filosófica de un nuevo orden global. Además, Matías ha sido profesor visitante en la Universidad Nacional de Singapur, Universidad de Nueva York, Universidad de Abu Dhabi y Universidad de Leuphana en Alemania. Yo quisiera pedirle al profesor Ruise que esta no sea la primera y última visita a nuestra universidad, sino que establezcamos un nexo de trabajo conjunto, porque nos honra mucho su presencia y porque esta temática está en el centro de la importancia para nuestra universidad. Además, hoy entonces nos va a entregar su visión sobre la difícil situación que enfrentamos como país la que estoy seguro enriquecerá la reflexión y el diálogo que como universidad nos proponemos seguir impulsando. Para finalizar, quisiera decir que agradezco su presencia, agradezco al Centro de Políticas Públicas, a su director Ignacio Larraza y a su gran equipo por poner en organización este seminario, este encuentro, y de manera muy especial a Mario Valdivia y su señora que están hoy día acá. Mario es director de la Fundación Friends UC, que nos ha apoyado en la visita de Matías, nos ha apoyado en la gestión para poder tenerlo acá con nosotros. Creo que el aporte de Mario ha sido sustantivo, le debemos a él la posibilidad de estar con el profesor Ruice, y lo nombro porque muchas veces hay un desconocimiento de quienes hacen posible que nosotros podamos disfrutar de este diálogo y de este intercambio intelectual. Así que muchas gracias, Mario, muchas gracias a la señora también por estar hoy día acá, que nos honran con su asistencia. Gracias a todos y que tengamos una excelente presentación y también un excelente debate en el panel.
Thank you very much, Rector Sanchez. The honor is, of course, entirely mine that at a difficult time like this for Chile, it would be my voice that can be added to this mix. And I speak to you not so much mostly from the standpoint of being honored, but from a humble standpoint, from a standpoint of tremendous humility, because my perspectives on the problems in Chile really are entirely the perspectives of an outsider. So I submit them for your consideration as the positions of an outsider that you can choose then to apply to the current facts on the ground. But my contribution to this debate, to the extent that it exists, would be of somebody who is grounded in political thought and in the human rights tradition, and will do his best to apply some insights from those traditions to the current situation in Chile. So that is where I come from. We did have some involvement with the protests in Chile, also in the Boston area. So as you probably know, there were quite a number of demonstrations really around the world, and especially in the United States, in expressions of solidarity with the political ambitions of the protest. And this one here is in Boston in Copley Square, and then closer to home in Cambridge, which is a city right next to Boston. That's where Harvard University is located. This is a demonstration in solidarity with the protests here in Chile and on Harvard Square just a few weeks ago. So that's just a few hundred meters away from my office. So to that extent, this was closer to home. What I'm going to do is I'm going to submit about 15 points to you. So you will see these numbers up there to bring some structure into the ideas that I'd like to submit to you. And the first one is in a way a generic reminder of something that we tend to forget, namely how precious and rare political order is, how difficult it is to establish political order, and how easy it is to lose political order, especially among larger groups of human beings. So the genetic setup that we have as human beings really equip us fairly well to interact in small groups, right? The original bands of humans that then spread around the world were groups of about 100 to 200, and was only in the process of the formation of culture of larger societies that we started to live together in structures that were larger than these 100 to 200, and then eventually substantially larger. And to this day, it is quite obvious that we as human beings don't quite know how to do that. You know? So to live together in large structures is tremendously difficult. So it's just an important reminder that order in political societies is not the default, it's not the normal case, it's something that is always brittle and precious, and it will always take an enormous effort to maintain it at an acceptable level. I say acceptable level, well, of course, it is one thing to establish order, but we don't want just any order, right? So it's one thing to establish order, it's a different thing and an even more difficult task to establish an order that is legitimate. And so graveyards are orderly places, prison systems can be orderly systems. That's not the kind of order we want. We want a kind of order that is justifiable to people, that makes sense to people, that people understand, make sense of their position, is responsive to them. So in particular, we want an order in which coercive state power is in principle justifiable to everybody, right? Why are we asking you to comply with law? Why are we asking you to accept law that in principle is also then going to be enforced by the police? Well, we can reasonably ask you to accept that really only if power is organized in such a way that is justifiable to you, and that is what the point of legitimate order is. Yeah? So we don't want just any order. We want a legitimate order. Then, of course, the question is, what is a legitimate order? What are the criteria for legitimacy? What makes a type of order legitimate as opposed to these other type of orders that we may have on graveyards or in prison systems? So what are criteria for legitimate governance? And here are what I think are a number of necessary conditions for legitimate governance. So one necessary condition for legitimate governance is that there has to be some kind of democratic approval process. You know, so you are, as a government, you are not ruling legitimately. You don't have the right to rule unless there's some democratic process of vindication behind that, so that with some credibility you can actually say that you are a government for the people, of the people, and by the people, which is this very famous phrase by Abraham Lincoln. The second condition of legitimate government governance is that there actually has to be a deliverance of overall positive outcomes, beneficial outcomes for the people. So you must actually deliver the goods for the people in order to have the right to rule. That would be a second necessary condition for legitimate government. And then a third necessary condition is that there has to be an in principle responsiveness to each citizen by adopting adequate policies to advance human rights. Yeah, so responsiveness to each citizen, of course, doesn't mean that the government has to be or can reasonably be asked to be actually in touch with every single citizen. But the point is more that there has to be that the set of policies that the government is implementing is actually responsive to the fact that everybody, every person has an individual life to lead, and that these individual lives that people need to lead need to be protected by policies that are attentive to people's human rights. You know, so that individual citizens are taken seriously as individuals, as persons in their own right. That is another third necessary condition on legitimate government. So it's important to add this human rights criterion, because there's a lot of governments in the history of the world that have been successful through some kind of democratic legitimacy. So condition one would be met, that were successful by delivering the goods, for example, by creating a decent amount of economic growth. But economic growth by itself may not trickle down to everybody. It may not apply to everybody. It may not benefit everybody. It might be a success in the aggregate, but it may still violate the concerns, the human rights concerns of individuals. So that's why having this third condition, responsiveness to human rights, as a third criterion for legitimacy is very important. And the human rights movement as a whole, I think, is one of the great accomplishments in the course of human history. So the human rights movement as we know it has predecessors, of course, but it's really a 20th century phenomenon where a movement was founded, a set of organizations, a set of international networks, a bunch of international law that is really devoted to this idea that every individual life matters and that every individual life is deserving of certain protections, but also of certain provisions that the collectives, that the state or anybody in power really needs to help provide. And the purpose of all that is to do justice to what is often called human dignity, right? So the idea that everybody matters in their own terms, everybody has a life to live, everybody is deserving of respect, And that everybody is allowed to have and is in a position to live a life in which this kind of status of dignity becomes possible, that is a responsibility that we all share within a country and really then also at the global level. So one motivation behind the human rights movement is to say what happens to people in particular locations is not just a problem for that location, but is really a globally shared concern. Yeah? So that human rights also in the sense that they are located at the level of humanity and appeal to a broader sense of human sympathy and human solidarity. This is a very famous photo of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the chair of the Human Rights Commission. So the Universal Declaration that she's holding in her hands there was passed in December 1948, just turned 70 last year. This is one of my favorite photos from the 20th century, partly because you also see how Eleanor Roosevelt is holding that, is a little bit with a mixture of amazement and befuddlement, right? So as if she was asking, so what's going to come of this now, right? So it's as if she can't quite believe, you know, the success of her own efforts. And of course, realizing human rights is a struggle, has always been a struggle, will continue to be a struggle. Chileans actually have been on the forefront of these efforts, so there is deep connections between Chile, and there's ongoing deep connections between Chile and the human rights movement. So there's in particular these three Chilean human rights superstars that I'd like to honor. So the photo here closest to me, this is Alejandro Alvarez, who is a Chilean jurist who is really credited with the idea that there should be a body of international law making the protection of human rights everywhere a shared responsibility globally. And so that's a Chilean thought, so thank you for that. You have contributed that to the global discourse. Then Hernan Santa Cruz was the Chilean member on Eleanor Roosevelt's Human Rights Commission, and he is often credited with the thought that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights should not just contain civil and political rights, which are protections of personhood, but should also include social and economic rights, which are concerned with provisions, you know, making sure that everybody has a certain material status, has educational opportunities. So that's very much also a more broadly Latin American contribution to the human rights movement. But among other people, Santa Cruz very much stood for that. And then, of course, Michelle Bachelet is the current United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, which means she is the highest ranking official in the United Nations system who is actually responsible for the United Nations policies on human rights. If you want to know what Michelle Bachelet did on October 18th, I can tell you, because by some curious turn of fate, we actually had a Chilean evening at Harvard that Mario Valdivia also attended. So at the Carr Center for Human Rights, of which I'm the director, it really just happens by plain coincidence. We were hosting the High Commissioner, your former president, Michelle Bachelet, on that very day, October 18th, at the university. So you see here your former president, the High Commissioner, with my staff on October 18th. So moving on to point five. So I've already given you these three criteria, three necessary conditions for legitimate government. I'd like to add one more. So governmental legitimacy is also questioned when the value of human rights across the citizenry is highly unequal. What's the value of rights? Well, what I can do with the right. Yeah? So for example, one simple illustration of that is if we all have a right to a decent defense at a trial, but the possibility of a decent defense at a trial depends on whether you can afford a good lawyer or not, then the value of this particular right is uneven, right? Namely, then people who have a lot of money, for them the value of that right is a lot higher than those people who pro forma also have the right to a defense but can't afford one. So the value of this right would then be highly uneven. And so that is also one thing a government needs to do in order to be a legitimate government, in order to be a government that is really whose coercive powers are justifiable to the people, is to make sure that the value of rights is not highly unequally distributed among the citizenry. And then you can ask, well, what is the problem with the unequal value of rights? Well, if we live in a society that is economically highly unequal, then citizens typically have a certain kind of complaints that can be expressed in terms of the unequal value of human rights. You know, so often in highly economically unequal societies, we have a situation that people perceive that the government is much more concerned with some people than with others, right? So they are putting policies in place that favor some people, that is much more attentive to some people than to others. Another perception in economically highly unequal societies is that legal processes seem to tend to favor some people over others. And the third point is that opportunities for effective political participation, there's a word missing, for effective political participation seem to be unevenly distributed, right? So often in economically highly unequal societies, what some people want politically, how they want to engage politically, has much more of an impact on the government than what other people want, right? So there's political scientists are finding that all around the world, that governments tend to be much more responsive to the wealthy people in society, what they want, than to the poorer people in society. So all of these would be symptoms of an unequal value of human rights in society that would be a problem especially prevalent in economically highly unequal societies. Now, Chile is one of those countries. So Chile is an economically highly unequal country. So you're familiar, I'm assuming, with this measurement of inequality, the Gini coefficient. So having a Gini coefficient of 0.47 puts Chile among the 30 most unequal countries in the world, all of which are in either Latin America or Africa, right? So this is a very regional distribution. What you make of that number, how you interpret this Gini coefficient, to some extent depends on what you compare it to, right? So you can say within Latin America, Chile is kind of it's on the higher end, but it's not terribly unusual. It doesn't stand out enormously. That's one fact about that. Another fact about that is inequality in Chile has actually diminished over the last several decades. So during the time of the Pinochet dictatorship, there was a lot more inequality in Chile. So at the end of the Pinochet era, the Gini was close to 0.6, you know, which is substantially higher than what there is now. So there has been a gradual decline in inequality, a gradual betterment in terms of movements towards a more egalitarian society. But then you also have that within the OECD countries, so the industrialized countries that are unified by democratic ideals and a commitment to a high living standard, there's only one other country, so within this group of about 35 countries, that has more inequality, and that is Mexico, right? So the only other two countries within that club that even come remotely close to Chile's inequality are the United States and Turkey. So within the OECD, Chilean inequality clearly stands out, which suggests that there would actually be policy space within Chile to do something about that, since these other countries in the OECD seem to be capable of doing that. Now, and in light of that, it is not surprising that several of these points that are just listed, the kind of standard complaints that people have about the unequal value of human rights in highly economically unequal societies, that some of these complaints would be reflected in what the protesters have been saying about why they have taken to the streets. So these complaints include that privatized education, healthcare, and pension systems favor the wealthy and leave much of the population impoverished. So that would be a typical phenomenon that can be expressed as the value of human rights is highly unequal in the society, especially also since the situation here is that many Chileans need to go into substantial debt even to cover items in what's considered the basic social basket, like food, health, education, housing, and transport. Right? So these concerns about the unequal value of human rights in egalitarian societies are articulated very much by the protesters in Chile. Now, one interesting question that I know has been on many people's minds that I have often heard is people said, so why is this happening now? Right? So why now? Why not 5 years ago? Why not 10 years ago? Maybe why not a few months ago? So I don't have a really good answer to that, but I'd like to give you one comparison that might be useful. So one person who has addressed a structurally similar question with regard to the French Revolution, you know, which was in a way much more involved than the protest in Chile, of course, is Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote a very famous book in political sociology called L'Ancien Régime et la Révolution, so the ancient regime and the revolution. So he's asking, why did the French Revolution happen in July 1789? Why did the French Revolution happen under Louis the 16th? Why did the French Revolution not happen under Louis the 15th or under Louis the 14th, when the rule of the monarchy and the rule of the aristocracy was much harsher on the population than it was under Louis the 16th? You know, so under Louis the 16th, in fact, the monarchy had undertaken sustained efforts to be responsive to many of the concerns of the people. It had abolished many privileges. It had in fact introduced possibilities of participation of the middle class that hadn't existed. It was more responsive to the economic concerns of the citizens. Right? So Louis the 16th, in other words, was a much better king than, you know, the 15th and the 14th had even aspired to be. And yet it was Louis the 16th who was stuck with that revolution and not his two predecessors. And so what is the answer to that? Well, so the answer that Tocqueville suggests, and that may have some bearing on the situation in Chile also, is that it's not that the revolution happened in France because things were getting worse. It's not that the revolution happened in France at that time even though things were getting better along certain dimensions. It's precisely that the revolution happened in France at that time because things in terms of long-term trends were actually getting somewhat better. It's because of that that it happened, because that also made clear to the French population that there was a policy space for even more improvement. Right? So they had seen that it's within the range of political agency to improve things for them, which wasn't really the case under the previous kings. And so that is what triggered the revolution, a perception that human agency can actually bring about yet more improvements than what had been before. So I think there might be something useful there to apply to the Chilean situation also. One other thing about the kind of background tendency, so as we are thinking about inequality, so one major insight that hit basically all niches of academic life a few years ago comes from French economist Thomas Piketty in this by now very influential book Capital in the 21st Century. So in fact it became so influential, right? So people talked about the Piketty mania. So you know, this is an economist, right? So they normally don't get this kind of claim, right? So it's kind of no intellectuals normally get this kind of claim, but this book made a major splash because it defended a thesis that, once he put it out there, struck many people as enormously plausible and as something that definitely needs to have an impact on policymaking, namely that capitalism inherently generates inequality over generations. You know? So the point is that in a capitalist economy, those who own things, those who own the means of production, the factories, those who basically own the economy, they benefit from the economy more than the economy as such grows, which means if you own something in a capitalist economy, you will benefit from the capitalist economy more than if you just work there. Yeah? So the factory owner benefits from the capitalist economy more than the factory worker. And if this continues over a number of generations, then we see a lot of ossification in society. We see a lot of tendencies that what you can do in life will increasingly depend on your station in life, right? Because there has been so much inheritance over the generations, and every generation this phenomenon is observed again, that those people who own benefit from the economy more than those who just work there. And what's interesting about this is, Piketty submits that this is something about capitalism that in the 20th century we just didn't notice. So the 20th century is the time when capitalism really took over much of the world, right? So and really established itself more than it had been before. So why didn't we notice in the 20th century that capitalism has these inherent tendencies? Well, the answer to that is that in the 20th century there was so much destruction of wealth in the two world wars and in the Great Depression, which then in turn also mobilized a lot of political will for change, that these inherent tendencies of capitalism to generate more and more inequality over the generations wasn't noticed, right? So we are noticing it now, since in recent decades there's been much more peace in the world than there was in the first several decades of the 20th century. Right? So now we are seeing these inherent tendencies of capitalism of generating inequality over generations. We see that much more strongly, you know, which is an interesting insight, especially for Chile, because it means Chile might well be at a point where we have seen a fair amount of political momentum after the Pinochet dictatorship, but in a way that momentum might be running out and the normal tendencies of capitalism that Piketty demonstrates might be kicking in much more strongly. And then increasingly, not just Chile, but this is happening in the United States, this is happening in Europe, this is happening everywhere. We are coming to societies where, again, your station in life at birth, you know, what kind of educational opportunities you have, what kind of house you can afford, what kind of places you get to live, right? That is fixed to a large extent at birth. And so this is not inevitable, right? So point 11 is inequality, even though there's these inherent tendencies in capitalism, it still requires policies to actually do it. Which also means there's policies that you can use to undo it, right? So we are designing society, right? So we are making society something, and it could be something else. And policies like this tend to be implemented either to make sure that inequality grows, or they can also be implemented in order to make sure that societies are becoming more inclusive, that they are acting deliberately against an increase of inequality. So there's measures like increasing the minimum wage, possibly to an actual living wage, to make sure that people and their families can live on wages. Fight against tax evasion is another theme. Sovereign wealth funds, of course, Chile does that already. There's a lot of potential there. Measures against rent-seeking, right? Rent-seeking phenomena where people are taking more out of the economy than their role in the economy actually merits, right? We often find that people from wealth and privilege find ways of putting legislation in place or influencing the government to put legislation in place that allows them to benefit from the economy disproportionately in ways that does not reflect the importance of their economic contributions. That's what's meant by rent seeking. There's a lot of that happening all around the world, so one could take measures against that. One could consider income and wealth taxes. So this is Piketty's own proposal, actually, a wealth tax. This is actually Elizabeth Warren in the United States. One of the Democratic contenders has adopted that proposal of a wealth tax. inheritance tax, right? One could think about, I mean, inheritance is, of course, a key mechanism in this increase of inequality over generations, right? That some people end up with a very privileged station in life because they have inherited something from what their parents or otherwise ancestors have accomplished, and therefore have a relative social standing in the next generation that other people will never match because they have not had an inheritance, right? So there's a possibility there. Other things to do to increase egalitarian tendencies is to make public transportation better so that people can benefit from opportunities in society, can actually get places, improve the public healthcare system, improve pension systems, improve the public education system, improve the design of cities so that they actually work for people, that they are easy places for people to navigate and make connections, and of course then also generally macroeconomic and monetary policy. So there's a lot of things that one can do in order to shape society in a way that is more or less inclusive. And my point in terms of the Piketty connection here is, unless measures like that are taken, and this is a point that applies generically, it applies to Chile, it applies to the United States, it applies everywhere, unless we are taking measures like that very actively and deliberately, the natural tendencies of capitalism towards more inequality will kick in very substantially. But it's not a natural process. It's a human design process that in such ways can also be counteracted. So now going directly to the protests. Now one key distinction as one is looking at the protests, as one is judging what's happening here, is the distinction between policy-based protests and legitimacy-based protests. Yeah? So if you have a policy-based protest, then this is basically a disagreement about what kind of policy there should be. So you might be protesting then if there's something that the government does that you think should be done differently. But it's a disagreement about particular policies. It's not a disagreement whose nature is that you think your standing as an equal participant in society itself is actually questioned. Yeah? It's not a protest against the very legitimacy of the government. Yeah? So there's this other type of protest, namely legitimacy-based protest, that occurs when the protests are not about particular policies, but they are questioning the very legitimacy of the government because the government is said not to respect the equal status of every citizen. And so legitimacy-based protests would then be protests that are concerned with violations of these various criteria of legitimate governments that are listed earlier. Right? So human rights violations would be one example, democratic malpractices would be one example, but also a large inequality in the value of human rights, that also would be a cause for legitimacy-based protest. Yeah? So protesters are saying there's so much inequality in this country that the value of human rights for us is so much less than it is for other people in society, then the nature of their protest would be legitimacy-based rather than policy-based. And that makes a massive difference, right? How you think about you as citizens of Chile, how the government of Chile thinks about these particular protests generically and the ones that you currently have in particular, whether they are policy-based protests or legitimacy-based protests, that makes a world of difference, right? Because it makes a world of difference in terms of how you think about who needs to do what about this. You know? It makes a world of difference also what kind of responses by the police or possibly the military would be acceptable. You know? And this is really something where all of you involved with this really need to make a political decision, need to think how you want to see these protests, right? Whether you as Chileans want to say, this is policy disagreement, therefore they shouldn't be doing any number of things they're doing, or whether you are saying, no, they actually, there's at least some of that has a point, many people there have a point, because what they are really articulating is a legitimacy-based protest, in which case the causes of that would need to be tackled, investigated, and then remedied. You know? So from my position as an outsider, this very much seems to me a legitimacy-based protest, but it's really a call for Chileans to make up their minds about that. Now, if you do have a legitimacy-based protest, so what are some of the implications then? Well, you can think of the kind of measures that are done, that are taken during a protest. You can think of them as persuasive or non-persuasive. Yeah? So if I'm protesting in a persuasive manner, I'm trying to change your mind. So you do something, you decide to do something, I don't like it, I protest, I explain to you why you are wrong. That's a persuasive protest. You know? So I'm trying to change the reasons that you have. A non-persuasive protest is something that I do to get you to do something, even though you don't want to do that. You know? So you don't have reason to do that yourself. But my non-persuasive protest to you is to try to get you to do something else anyway. So that's a non-persuasive protest. And notice non-persuasive protest that covers a whole range. You know? So a strike, a boycott, a blockade, a sit-in, a teach-in, a walkout, all of these are non-persuasive means of protest, right? We are trying to be disruptive, right? So strikes is really the main example here, right? Non-persuasive protest, it's about disruption. It's not automatically about destruction or violence, right? Non-persuasive protest has this range of manifestations from disruption to destruction to violence. Yeah? So when you have a policy-based protest, anything other than persuasive protest, persuasive measures will be unacceptable, right? Because we have an intramural, in-house disagreement. If you have a legitimacy-based protest, then non-persuasive means are becoming debatable, right? So if it's actually about legitimacy, then disruption is acceptable, right? So if you agree with this analysis that we have a legitimacy-based protest, then disruption itself is justifiable, and in that case, the main emphasis should be, the main burden is on the government to actually address the causes of the protest, and really also to do that regardless of whether the protesters, what kind of measures they end up, what kind of non-persuasive measures they are turning to. Right? So the focus then really should be on addressing the underlying causes that gave rise to the legitimacy-based protest. And because that's so, because we are then acknowledging that these are legitimacy-based protests, there's also a substantial responsibility on the side of the government to deal with the fallout from the protest, you know, because the dynamics that came out of that have at least a legitimate core, even though, of course, a lot of what might have been going on in the protest was by itself not acceptable. But the emphasis really should be on fixing the underlying causes. Now, then, of course, the question on many people's minds is, what do we make of the destruction and the violence? Is that acceptable? Is that within this range of non-persuasive protests, is that something that we should condone? So what I'd like to say to that is, so I do not want to pass a judgment on how bad things are and what non-persuasive means exactly are acceptable because of that. But I would like to offer 4 points to protesters who are considering non-persuasive means beyond disruption, right? So 4 points that I think protesters should think about as they are contemplating destruction or possibly violence. And these 4 points are, so the first point is what research generally shows. In fact, one of my senior colleagues at the Carr Center, her name is Erica Chenoweth. She is a world-renowned expert on nonviolent resistance, and she has done much of the key research in that. And her finding actually is that nonviolent resistance, so resistance that limits itself to disruption rather than anything stronger, actually has a much better chance in the long run of showing success than violent resistance or destruction. So people refusing in sustained ways to abide by an established order, they succeed by eventually making it morally and practically impossible for the ruling class to ignore their demands. You know, so protests in the United States under Martin Luther King would be a standard example for that, or also resistance to the government of Serbia more recently would be a standard example for that. Right? So simply people refusing in nonviolent ways to abide by an order that eventually would win over so many people in society, including in law enforcement, that the government simply has to give in. Right? So even though around here there might be the perception that it's actually because of violence that there were successes, it's probably not so much because of the violence, but because of the mass mobilization that was done in response to the violence, which in principle one may well also have been able to generate without the violence. Right? So research really shows here that nonviolent resistance has better chances of success. Point two, of course, is any kind of protest has a way of bringing out people whose concerns are not political, whose concerns, or at least they are not aligned with the concerns of the people who are protesting. Right? So they have all sorts of other motivations to be part of those protests. They have all sorts of other motivations to engage the police and escalate any kind of violence. And of course, that's also something one needs to consider as one thinks about non-persuasive means of protest, that people might join you in that who would be strange bedfellows for your own cause. Yeah. Third point is once you turn to destruction and especially to violence, what this will inevitably involve is that particular individuals will be singled out for humiliation, for injury, possibly for killing. So the dynamics unleashed will be directed against particular people, right? And what happens then is that you are basically blaming people, you are holding people accountable, you are discharging anger against particular people that really is directed at a whole system, right? at a whole economic and political system. And I think there's a very deep moral wrong involved in holding individuals accountable. Most individuals, right? Some people obviously are more accountable than others, but the people who are most likely affected by protest in the street most likely are people who really are just cogs in the wheel. Any progress made by such means then I think will be tarnished for wrongfully singling out individuals for wrongs attributable to a whole system. And point four, and this is maybe the most important thing to say here, so if you are, especially if you are part of the young generation and you think there really needs to be change, and we bring about change and through destruction or violence, because the older generation just couldn't do it for us, right? So we need to do that, and this is the violence and destruction is the price worth paying. One thing to think about that is really also what this does to you, what this does to your character, what this does to your capacities to be a political agent in the long run. Right? So if you see politics as something that is done with destruction or violent means, then this will always be an option. Right? This will always be an option for you. The other side will know it's an option, so they will make it an option. So you're going down a very problematic road where politics in the end is very much shaped by the presence of violent actions. It happened very much in South Africa, right? So in the African National Congress was a peaceful movement until the late 1950s when Nelson Mandela decided that violence was the way going forward. That's why then he spent 30 years in prison because of that. And this move towards violence radically transformed the African National Congress itself, right? The kind of political agency that they were capable of showing radically changed. So that is a problem that so turning to violence makes violence acceptable as a political means, and it really also changes people's characters, right? It might create a kind of bitterness if you see politics as the kind of thing, you know, you go there and you set fire to a subway station. It might create so much bitterness in yourself that in the long run you would be incapable of implementing positive change. You know, that's the fourth point. So that was speaking to the protesters. Now, speaking to the government and really the part of society that is on the privileged side as of now, my suggestion would be that the main order of business really should be to address the causes to make sure that there's no circle of violence happening going forward. So that should be the priority of the government, and I'm delighted to hear that the government is to a large extent already doing that. So they are to some extent already doing that, and the key now would actually be to do that in a credible way, so that it's that there's not going to be a perception in a couple of years that this was just some kind of window dressing. At the same time, the government should show extreme restraint also in its responses to the violence, given that its own legitimacy here is very much at issue. And just to keep in mind that legitimacy-based protests, because of the strong perception that people have that they are in the right, have ways of generating radicalization that then in turn will prompt more draconian police responses. So there's a very strong possibility of more and more radicalization. So the main order of business here really should be to address the underlying causes. Which brings me to my conclusion. So one other political classic to bring in here is Aristotle's Politics. Many of you will have encountered this book at some point in your studies. The reason this has become a classic in political theory is because it is concerned with the problem that we still have today, that Chile very much has today, that many other countries have today, namely that a political process is always about balancing different claims to power that people make. You know, and Aristotle in this book is exploring different constitutional arrangements in which this could be done. And if no good solution is found, then the state is basically falling apart. Yeah? And again, remember, order is something very hard to come by, very easy to lose. So the politics is about thinking about ways of balancing different claims to power. So for Chile, what this means is, so there's the protesters' claim to a renewal of legitimacy, but that, of course, needs to be squared with the concerns of many of large parts of the Chilean population that too much change will create alienation, right? So too much and too fast change will create alienation, will stifle the economy, and would get wealthier Chileans to invest their money in other economies rather than here, right? So that's there has to be a balancing of these claims in order to make sure that the state is not falling apart, which is the advice that is coming out of Aristotle's Politics. And some suggestions for that would be, so to keep human rights front and center, I think, is key, and is also connecting to the strong Chilean tradition in contributing to the human rights movement. So keep human rights front and center. Everybody's human rights, right? So the protesters' human rights, everybody else's human rights, the human rights also of the police that are out in the street and dealing with the first order dimensions of business. Inequality will have to be tackled directly with an awareness of the natural tendency of capitalism towards more inequality. If that is not done, there will remain this perception of the unequal value of human rights, which will just circle back in more legitimacy-based complaints in the future. And one thing one could do here is also to really seize this opportunity and to say, you know, we think of this as a painful wake-up call, and we are trying to realize ideals of what's sometimes called deliberative democracy. And so a democracy with a lot of shared deliberation, with a lot of, with the multi-stakeholder process of really Chileans taking charge of their society. So a multi-stakeholder process involving civil society, academia, but of course also the government, the private sector, and then very importantly, I think, civil education. So it's, you know, the future is always in the young generation, right? And so how the young generation sees the world has a lot to do with what happens at school, and a sustained civic education to make young people proud to be Chilean citizens, I think, is really a key, to be proud to be Chilean citizens who are proud contributors to a deliberative democratic process to take charge of the problems of the country. And what this might mean practically is a transformation into a political model that maintains the competitive markets that have been characteristic of Chile in the last several decades, but combines it with a much strengthened, perhaps European-style welfare state to create greater inclusiveness to address this issue of the unequal value of human rights, and then to embed all of that into a deliberative understanding of democracy to engender a sense of shared citizenship. So again, keep in mind as I'm winding up, so this is very much perspectives of an outsider without much knowledge about the situation in Chile. This is humbly submitted to you for your consideration, which is why also I'm going to give the last word to a local intellectual hero. So Gabriela Mistral formulated this very nice saying about Chile: the whole land is like one favorite spot of human life. You know, the whole land is like one favorite spot of human life. There's few things one could say of any country that are more beautiful than that, and I think the challenge right now is to make that true for everybody going forward. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias, señor Matías Rice. Ahora daremos inicio a un panel de conversación para dialogar en torno a las temáticas expuestas en su charla. Invitamos a pasar adelante a los panelistas y al señor Ignacio Irarrázaval, quien moderará esta conversación.
Muchas gracias por la presentación, Matías, muy interesante, muchos puntos para analizar, profundizar, debatir, así que yo le quiero agradecer a nuestros distinguidos y distinguida panelista de esta mañana. Ya fueron presentados, pero voy a repasar rápidamente. Ana María Steuben hizo su doctorado en Historia en la Universidad de Stanford, y tal como se ha dicho, si bien trabaja en la Universidad Diego Portales, es profesora titular del Instituto de Historia de la Universidad Católica, así que podemos compartir ese privilegio. Y don Eduardo Valenzuela es sociólogo de la universidad, hizo sus estudios también en la Escuela de Altos Estudios de Ciencias Sociales de París, y es el actual decano de la Facultad de Ciencias Sociales. Entonces, la idea es hacer una pequeña introducción general por cada uno de los panelistas, unos 10 minutos, y después intentar hacer algún intercambio en el panel con el profesor Rice. ¿Quieres empezar tú, Ana María? Muchas gracias.
Bueno, quiero agradecer mucho a la universidad que me haya invitado a tener la oportunidad de leer y escuchar al profesor Rice, a Patricio Donoso, nuestro prorector, y a Ignacio, el director de Políticas Públicas. Es un honor. Bueno, hay al menos dos conceptos que orientan la presentación del profesor Rice: orden y desigualdad. Pero como él nos dice, no es cualquier orden. Es el orden legítimo el que justificaría el poder coercitivo del Estado a fin de que éste no sea, obviamente, pura dominación. Es requisito, dice, para el derecho a gobernar, y su legitimidad surge de tres factores: elecciones democráticas, de un reparto equitativo de los logros del sistema y de que sea responsable ante cada ciudadano en el respeto a los derechos humanos. Respecto de la desigualdad, el profesor Rice reconoce por lo demás lo que acaba de confirmar el PNUD, que si bien Chile tiene un alto índice de desarrollo humano en términos de ingresos, salud y educación, es uno de los más desiguales entre los 50 países con mayor desarrollo humano. La relación entre ambos conceptos es determinante. Mantener la legitimidad exige reducir la desigualdad. No hay duda que su reflexión es acertada. También que más que reivindicaciones concretas, sería equivocado creer que el precio del metro fue la razón y no un mero detonante, las protestas que hemos vivido están ancladas en problemas crecientes de legitimidad asociadas, creo yo, con las expectativas creadas por la transición. Para superarlas, dice también el profesor Rice, se requiere voluntad política, porque los cambios implican, entre otros, problemas de inclusión, de superación de los privilegios provenientes de las situaciones de nacimiento y de herencia. Las menciones que hace a las reflexiones de Tocqueville sobre lo que en lenguaje contemporáneo llamaríamos la revolución de expectativas son acertadas también. Me permito evocar una frase del mismo Tocqueville cuando dice que el yugo, cuanto más leve, es más intolerable.
Con ello, reconocemos que Chile ha hecho avances significativos en disminución de la pobreza, en acceso al consumo y en crecimiento hasta hace algunos años. Sin embargo, a pesar de ello, hemos vivido una explosión social. Me voy a detener en dos temas relacionados con su exposición, agregando una perspectiva interpretativa de la historia de Chile en su larga, mediana y corta duración. Me refiero al problema del orden social y al problema de lo político, como herramienta interpretativa de los problemas actuales. Lo político, en la definición de Pierre-Rosan Vallon, va más allá de la lucha por el poder, es decir, abarca todo aquello que constituye la polis, no solo lo inmediato, partidario y ordinario de la vida de las instituciones. Incluye, por ejemplo, también lo simbólico, la memoria, la cultura, las expectativas, la tradición histórica y su comprensión, porque nuestra democracia y los problemas asociados a ella tienen raíces que vale la pena evocar, no porque ésta se repita, sino porque de una dimensión de la temporalidad es porque nos explican una dimensión de la temporalidad de nuestra crisis. El primero de los temas entonces a que me voy a referir, el orden social, me permite hablar de la larga duración. Las clases dirigentes chilenas que construyeron la República lo hicieron desde el temor a la inclusión. Por ello, fueron capaces, desde lo político, de convertirla en una promesa con sentido de futuro a través de la construcción de un relato sobre el Estado en transición, al mismo tiempo que concebir una colectividad humana que conciliara los predicamentos de la política moderna con los vínculos sociales y las creencias del grupo dirigente. Para lo cual, como decía O'Higgins, la confianza era la garantía contra la impotencia de la autoridad. Y lograron hacer que su promesa fuera creíble, la esperanza puesta en la educación, en la ampliación del sufragio. Otorgaron un tiempo a la política para construir ese horizonte. Por supuesto que hubo desajustes y protestas, pero una clase dirigente homogénea y consciente de que su primer recurso de fuerza era el consenso en su interior, permitió que navegaran en las aguas de la modernidad atentos a los riesgos mayores. No eran ingenuos y por eso estuvieron abiertos a acuerdos programáticos. El resorte de la máquina de que hablaba Portales sería, en palabras de Mario Góngora, justamente esa capacidad de identificar en la clase dirigente el rango social y sus intereses anexos con la cualidad moral de preferir el orden público al caos. El orden era la cualidad moral de una clase que además definía esa cualidad moral. Todo cambio social y político dependía de evitar la amenaza proferida por Sarmiento cuando escribió en 1842 que las cuestiones sociales... ¡Uy, qué horror! Parece mi teléfono, perdón. Perdón. Vuelvo a Sarmiento. Cuando Sarmiento dice, en 1842, las cuestiones sociales, después de ventiladas por el pensamiento, pasan a ser ventiladas por las pasiones, por las bayonetas, hasta caer rodando a los pies de las masas, tribunal sin apelación. La clase dirigente chilena confió en la política y construyó su arquitectura republicana y enfrentó las crisis y desafíos de la modernidad, intentando evitar que la política y la sociedad corrieran por carriles separados. Por supuesto que la guerra, además victoriosa, como factor de unidad en momentos de crisis, ayudó mucho a la cohesión en torno al Estado. En el siglo XX, este edificio se desmorona, en parte porque surge un nuevo sector social. Es el momento en que voy a asociar con la mediana duración. Ya en la Revolución del 91 hubo un quiebre social, aunque de corta duración. Y me voy a permitir hacer un pequeño paréntesis en este relato. En estos meses ha rondado la pregunta sobre las crisis del siglo XX como un recurso interpretativo para las crisis actuales. 1903, los estibadores de Valparaíso, 1905, contra el impuesto a la carne, 1906, los caldereros de Antofagasta, 1907, la matanza de Santa María de Iquique, y suma y sigue. Todas fueron también muy violentas, con un número muy alto de muertes, también con saqueos y presencia militar y policial. Sin embargo, creo que es un error entenderlas, para usar la adecuada tipología del profesor Rice, como crisis que responden solo a estímulos desatados por determinadas políticas. el mismo error que sería entender la actual desde el alza del metro. Pero volviendo al relato, no está de más citar estas crisis porque como las de hoy responden, y aquí sigo la tipología del profesor Rice, en su otro tipo de protesta, a crisis de legitimidad, no solo del gobierno, sino del sistema como un todo. El sistema cuestionado a comienzos del siglo XX proviene de una deslegitimación de la promesa fundacional del sistema republicano. Lograr que los nuevos sectores, especialmente el proletariado, alcanzaran el nivel de inclusión y de participación que demandaban, para lo cual habían firmado un cheque en blanco a inicios de la República. La crisis del centenario de la República en 1910 surge del desajuste entre el pueblo como lo concreto, lo colectivo, su principio sociológico y lo institucional, que tiene una dimensión más abstracta que disuelve su contenido. Se rompe el rol simbólico de lo político y, como hoy, irrumpen sectores difíciles de determinar, con demandas concretas pero también simbólicas que desafían el sistema político. El tema de la promesa es fundamental. A comienzos del siglo XX la historia se acelera, ya no hay tiempo para seguir esperando. Lo político y lo social parecen correr por carriles separados. La clase dirigente pierde espacio para negociar y la sociedad, más heterogénea y compleja, incorpora ciudadanos que no se conocen entre sí ni tienen elementos en común. ¿Qué más distante, por ejemplo, que Benjamín Sorcasó y Nicolás Palacio? Pero todos coinciden en que viven una crisis social y cultural como lo hacemos hoy. La decadencia de la clase dirigente y de la clase política, una educación y una economía que no incluyen a todos, un déficit cultural. Un país que avanza con formas políticas modernas, pero con una sociedad y una economía de antiguo régimen. Chile es una preciosa rapiña para los fuertes, llegó a decir Vicente Huidobro. Y ahora me refiero a la corta duración de nuestra historia. En síntesis, Chile ha vivido un proceso de transición durante el siglo XIX hacia la actualización de los requisitos republicanos, con una clase dirigente apoyada en lo político, abierta al cambio como promesa, en la medida que no se alterase el orden social. La confianza en esta promesa entra en una crisis profunda, como digo, a inicios del siglo XX, tan profunda que abarca todo el sistema político y que desencadena incluso un cambio de régimen político. La llegada de Arturo Alessandri al poder es su corolario. Los 30 años de transición a la democracia pueden compararse con ese proceso. Y ahora, la dictadura de Pinochet cuestionó profundamente eso que Rice llama la excepcionalidad chilena construida durante el siglo XIX. Desencadenó una crisis de identidad nacional, una herida en la definición de la nación. Le sigue lo que hemos llamado transición a la democracia. Permítanme detenerme un momento en el concepto de transición. Transición implica un proceso, un espacio. Se pasa de algo a otra cosa, de un momento histórico a otro. Es decir, transición implica tiempo. La frase del presidente Elwin sobre la medida de lo posible es justamente eso, una medida, lo posible en un tiempo determinado. A eso, nuevamente, el país dio un cheque en blanco, a una transición que se inicia con la misma promesa que la República, inclusión y participación en un Estado que legítimamente puede ejercer el poder porque ahora es democrático. Pero, como dice también Rosán Balón, la democracia es un campo, es decir, un espacio donde se entrelaza la vida de las personas, la sociedad apoyada en un principio donde las diferencias y las desigualdades se hacen admisibles a través de justificaciones creíbles. También la democracia es un trabajo, un proceso para hacer comunidad, un proceso donde se negocia el conflicto por medio de la política y se elaboran las reglas. En ese sentido, un campo abierto que mantiene un horizonte de futuro. Lo que hoy hace agua justamente es el horizonte de futuro. Por eso hay tantos jóvenes involucrados, son los que tienen más futuro por delante. A sus padres no se les cumplió la promesa y ya no creen que se les cumplirá a ellos. Especialmente no se cumplió la promesa que justifica el neoliberalismo. El mercado como articulador e integrador está agotado. Si el consumo y los bienes materiales son la principal pulsión en una sociedad donde el éxito individual, como en el calvinismo, es señal de salvación, eso se alejó paulatinamente del horizonte de las personas. Además, su principio legitimador, su combustible cultural, su recurso de eficiencia simbólica, que era el acceso permanente a nuevas formas de consumo y la promesa de distribuir recursos en base al esfuerzo, falló. Entonces la desigualdad afloró a la superficie junto con el clasismo, el trato a veces indigno entre chilenos, entre generaciones, a los inmigrantes, a los que no tienen éxito. Y quienes eran los encargados de abrir el camino hacia su cumplimiento también fallaron. Se coludieron, estafaron, despreciaron el mundo del pensamiento y de la cultura. Pero mantuvieron el control, y a pesar del reconocimiento de errores por parte de algunos, creo que todavía no son capaces, como tampoco lo fueron, para diagnosticar el sentido real del malestar ciudadano que estaba incubando a sus pies. Termino con la misma pregunta que nos desvela a todos. ¿Cómo devolver el vapor a la olla? Una nueva constitución que diseñe un estado de mayor bienestar, con un estado menos subsidiario y mayores controles para la ambición personal y empresarial, es fundamental en lo estructural. Pero confío y creo igualmente necesario cambios culturales y un nuevo relato identitario donde reposicionemos palabras como dignidad, justicia, igualdad. Castells, cuando estuvo acá en Chile, dijo que eran las palabras que estaban siempre presentes en todas las demandas. Y agregaría también comunidad y solidaridad, tan desvalorizadas en el último tiempo. Me cuesta creer que los devotos del neoliberalismo, solo a través de políticas y no de un cambio de lo político, cambien sus paradigmas. Sigo viendo, por ejemplo, cuando ceden, por ejemplo, a mejorar los salarios de sus empleados y se resignan a un mayor gasto social, que intentan seguir como conductores del proceso. Y eso sin duda no es suficiente. Es decir, no basta con policy-based protests, como decía. Hay que pensar en cambios más profundos, en una nueva cultura que revierta lo que Lipovetsky definió como los efectos de la hipermodernidad, que se fortalezcan las convicciones, que se devuelva la credibilidad a las instituciones, que se reposicionen los actores colectivos, ojalá la Iglesia Católica, o al menos algunos de sus miembros que siguen siendo muy creíbles y que ojalá saquen la voz para recuperar identidades nacionales debilitadas, religiosas y culturales, que fueron fundacionales y que mantienen un capital simbólico y un capital social. Se trata de fortalecer a personas, a quienes tienen capacidad de movilización. Recuerdo de nuevo la frase Huidobro, crisis de hombres, gritaba. Repensar la democracia deliberativa, aumentando la participación, incluyendo a los jóvenes, a los marginados por el sistema, porque si no, ellos continuarán pensando que lo público no es de ellos y por lo tanto lo van a seguir destruyendo con rabia y atacando a un otro que los deja en manos de anarquistas y narcotraficantes. Porque termino con un dato realmente revelador. Si antes del estallido social el narco dominaba un tercio de algunas de las poblaciones, hoy domina la mitad de esas poblaciones. Hoy distribuye, da los suministros de los alimentos básicos, los narcos cuidan los niños, los narcos los llevan al colegio, los narcos chantajean a las personas. Ese es un escenario que tenemos que combatir, creo, a no dar más. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias, Ana María. Se suponía que esto era un comentario corto y más liviano, pero diste una charla muy profunda a los comentarios de Matías, así que creo que Matías lo va a agradecer. Don Eduardo Valenzuela.
Muchas gracias. Voy a ser breve. Voy a hacer dos comentarios a la muy interesante conferencia del profesor Matías Rice. A mí me parece que hay dos distinciones bien centrales en su conferencia, en su artículo. La primera es esta distinción al cual también se ha referido Ana María, entre una protesta que está basada en política, en una demanda por una política pública determinada, y una protesta que está basada en problemas de justicia y de legitimidad. Esa es una primera distinción, policy based versus justice or legitimate based protest, dice el profesor. Y la cuestión es dirimir si esta es una crisis que se inclina hacia uno o hacia el otro lado. Y tengo dos ejemplos de que la respuesta puede ser efectivamente que estamos ante una protesta de legitimidad. La primera, claro que quizás reinterpretando un poco lo que podría ser una protesta basada en política, la primera evidencia que nosotros tenemos la medimos en la encuesta bicentenario, yo lo he mencionado otras veces, y que tiene que ver con la respuesta que hoy da la gente respecto de la probabilidad que tiene un estudiante de escasos recursos de entrar a la universidad, de acceder a la educación superior. Hoy la gente sostiene que esa probabilidad ha bajado, es menor que la que había hace 2, 3, 4 o 5 años atrás. Entonces es bien notable que esa percepción de que existen más barreras en el acceso a la educación superior se produzca justo después de la política de gratuidad universitaria de la presidenta Bachelet. Piensen ustedes que es una política, quizás la política más considerable, más importante que ha construido el país en materia de inclusión social, una política de varios miles de millones de dólares, que sin embargo no tiene ningún rendimiento en la percepción de las personas. Entonces hay algo inquietante en la idea de que podemos hacer políticas públicas muy contundentes de inclusión social y el malestar continúa, no se mueve. Quizás podemos subir la base del pilar solidario de 110 a 160 mil pesos y quizás el malestar no se mueve. Entonces, ese es un primer argumento inquietante, creo yo, para mostrar que quizás detrás de esta crisis hay algo más que una cuestión de política pública, de política de inclusión. Hay una percepción de que el sistema en su conjunto pierde legitimidad. Un segundo ejemplo es el siguiente. A mí me chocó mucho. Después del primer paquete de política que el presidente Piñera anunció después de la crisis, como respuesta, como primera respuesta a la crisis, 5, 6 o 10 días después del estallido del 18 de octubre, un paquete que fue evaluado en alrededor de 1.000 millones de dólares en ese minuto y que incluía medidas bien importantes como el subsidio estatal al salario mínimo o el aumento del pilar solidario que ya he comentado, la encuesta CADEM estableció que la medida del conjunto de medidas que anunció el presidente, la medida mejor aprobada, aquella que suscitaba más adhesión, era la rebaja de la remuneración de los parlamentarios, que desde el punto de vista de política pública es insignificante. Entonces, son dos ejemplos que muestran que efectivamente estamos ante una crisis que probablemente apunta a problemas de justicia y de legitimidad del sistema político en su conjunto, no solo del gobierno, y que definen bien la naturaleza de esta crisis. Entonces, la distinción entre una crisis, entre un malestar que se basa en política versus un malestar que apunta a problemas de justicia y legitimidad, me parece una distinción bien importante. Quizás el problema no es solamente, no voy a exagerar, porque el mismo profesor Riese dice que la distinción de repente es difícil de establecer, pero quizás el problema no es el costo privado de ciertos bienes esenciales, como muchos hemos sostenido, ¿no es cierto?, que la gente paga mucho por cosas que le importan y cosas que considera crecientemente derecho, como la educación superior del 2011, como el transporte público, la previsión, la salud hoy día, y que quisiera efectivamente que el Estado le ayudara a soportar costos significativos para ello de ciertos bienes que se consideran derechos, que ha sido una aplicación fuerte de política pública para explicar el malestar, o bien tampoco quizás sea solo un problema de endeudamiento de la clase media que trata de acceder a bienes de consumo de mayor calibre, automóviles y cosas parecidas, y se endeuda para conseguir eso, y que naturalmente eso presiona sobre sus condiciones de vida, sino se trata también de problemas que están más allá del alcance incluso de ciertas políticas, aunque sean contundentes, de inclusión y de mejoramiento social. Entonces llamaría la atención, hay problemas de fondo, las encuestas lo vienen diciendo también hace un rato, la percepción de corrupción en las instituciones políticas y el descrédito general del sistema, no un problema de legitimidad de este gobierno o que este gobierno haya caído en tal o cual problema de legitimidad o que una institución clave como la policía lo haya hecho, es un problema del conjunto de las instituciones políticas, que incluye de manera muy central a la judicatura también, a los tribunales de justicia, a la operación de nuestro sistema judicial y no solo de nuestras instituciones parlamentarias y gubernamentales. La percepción de abuso empresarial, muy importante, ya no solo ni principalmente en el trato a los trabajadores, como era antiguamente y que llamábamos explotación, sino en el trato a los consumidores, que llamamos hoy día abuso, ¿no es cierto? Y la responsabilidad que tiene eventualmente la empresa, los empresarios, en dar un trato justo, no solo a su propia gente, sino a la gente a la cual él vende su producto. La percepción de desigualdad se ha mencionado muchas veces. En magnitud es el problema del tamaño de la desigualdad. Es demasiado la brecha que hay entre los que están arriba y abajo. O también es un problema de percepción de origen, ¿no? Que el origen mismo de la desigualdad es ilegítimo porque no está basado en el mérito, sino en otras cuestiones. Entonces son dos problemas distintos relacionados con la desigualdad. Uno que es muy alta, ¿no es cierto? Que es lo que dice. Otra es que su origen es ilegítimo. La percepción, ya digo, de que no existe igualdad de oportunidades, sobre todo por la segregación y la inequidad del sistema educativo, en fin. Hay cosas de fondo, detrás, que probablemente apuntan a una crisis de legitimidad. La segunda distinción que quiero comentar muy brevemente y que me parece muy muy interesante es la distinción entre métodos persuasivos y no persuasivos. La protesta efectivamente puede adquirir una u otro carácter. Quisiera simplemente reiterar y agradecer incluso el argumento del profesor Risse respecto de la debilidad de los métodos no persuasivos y de los riesgos que implica la radicalización de la protesta y el uso de la violencia. Son argumentos bien contundentes, yo los he resumido en tres, parece que eran cuatro, pero son tres los que retengo. Primero, los gobiernos responden ante movilizaciones de masa y ante encuestas y no necesariamente ante la violencia. Si fuera solamente violencia, es decir, saqueo o riots, disturbios y enfrentamientos contra la policía, como los hubo, por ejemplo, y los hay en muchos países, Londres, Inglaterra en 2011, Francia en 2005, ¿no es cierto? Grandes levantamientos que básicamente terminan en una refriega contra la policía. Si fuera solo eso, bueno, la respuesta de los gobiernos es una política de cohesión comunitaria, una determinada política para los grupos más desfavorecidos, aliviar la situación de los inmigrantes pobres en sus barrios, en fin. Pero si es solo violencia, lo que está en juego no son nunca problemas estructurales, problemas de fondo. Lo que hace que haya aquí un problema de legitimidad, lo que hace que la crisis sea una crisis de legitimidad, no son los muchachos enardecidos, son el hecho de que hay muchos miles de personas que se manifiestan en las calles y en las encuestas y en cualquier situación que están respaldando cierto programa de reforma social. Lo segundo, argumento contra la violencia. contra la radicalización de la protesta es esta idea de que si uno personaliza en el gobierno del tipo renuncia a Piñera, o si uno cree que el problema es el ministro del Interior y lo acusamos constitucionalmente y radicalizamos políticamente un movimiento en torno a ciertas figuras, uno enmascara los aspectos estructurales de la crisis y debilita la capacidad de responder estructuralmente frente a la crisis, como si el problema fuese el ministro del Interior, que actuó en una determinada circunstancia. Entonces, la radicalización de la protesta tiene ese efecto de torcer el sentido de la crisis misma y del fondo de esa crisis. La tercer argumento es muy importante, la violencia, como dice el profesor, alivia la rabia de algunos, pero genera la de otros. Genera sentimientos de revancha, destruye la posibilidad de generar consenso, de avanzar en los problemas de fondo. La violencia tiene el riesgo de transformar todo esto en un problema de orden público, en llevar todo esto a una reforma a la policía y no mucho más, y por ende de hacernos olvidar el problema, las causas estructurales, los problemas de fondo que tenemos como país, y entorpece la posibilidad realmente de resolverlo. Hay que decirle a los muchachos que la violencia es contraproducente, no apunta a los problemas reales y entorpece la solución de esos problemas. La violencia no es el motor de este movimiento, al contrario, es esencialmente su entorpecedor. La segunda pregunta que a mí me surge es cómo hacer prevalecer métodos persuasivos. Y yo diría, efectivamente, en el medio de una crisis, los métodos persuasivos son los más improbables, los que vamos a tener más dificultades para establecer. Pero los métodos persuasivos, a mi juicio, requieren al menos tres cosas fundamentales. Lo primero, porque aquí se trata de hacer probable lo improbable. ¿Cómo hacemos que en medio de una crisis prevalezcan los métodos persuasivos y se impongan sobre los no persuasivos? El primero, la primera cosa que me parece es fundamental es la capacidad de respuesta que tenga el gobierno y en general quienes tienen autoridad y poder. En inglés se dice responsiveness, capacidad de responder, capacidad de darse cuenta del problema y de responder, cosa que compromete no solo al gobierno, sino a los tecnócratas, a los empresarios, a nosotros, los profesores, los intelectuales, en fin, ¿no? Responder significa escuchar, admitir que quizás uno se ha equivocado en algo, tener la capacidad de pensar algunas cosas de otra manera, a como las había pensado antes. Es fundamental tener entonces una élite y un gobierno con capacidad de respuesta frente a una crisis como esta. Si tuviésemos, y afortunadamente no lo hemos tenido, un gobierno o una élite sin esa capacidad de responsiveness, las cosas serían peores a como son probablemente hoy. La segunda cuestión que me parece esencial para hacer prevalecer métodos no persuasivos es la disposición hacia el acuerdo, especialmente hacia el acuerdo parlamentario. Subrayo la importancia enorme que en estas crisis tiene el Senado por encima de la Cámara de Diputados. Una vez se pregunta qué tiene que ver el Senado, por qué tenemos dos cámaras. Bueno, tenemos dos cámaras por esto, porque el Senado ejerce una función moderadora, opera con quórum más alto, exige y tiende al consenso de una manera mucho más profunda. Imagínense esta crisis librada a la otra, solamente en nuestra Cámara de Diputados. La disposición al acuerdo parlamentario es clave. Todo lo que favorezca la capacidad de crear consenso en situaciones como esta es fundamental. Y una tercera condición, con esto termino, simplemente es decir, necesitamos no solo capacidad de respuesta, responsiveness de los quienes tienen poder, capacidad de lograr acuerdos, sino también cierta disposición de la ciudadanía, de todos nosotros, a retirar apoyo al uso de la violencia en cualquiera de sus manifestaciones. Sin eso, no vamos a conseguir hacer prevalecer métodos persuasivos. El problema de la violencia no son los grupos violentos, es la legitimidad social que prestamos a ciertas acciones violentas. Ese es el problema de la violencia, que hay mucha gente que no es violenta en ningún sentido relevante, pero que aprueba, apoya, a veces tácita, a veces explícitamente, actos de violencia. Necesitamos esencialmente bajar ese nivel de aprobación que existe respecto del uso de la violencia en cualquiera de sus manifestaciones. Creo que con estas tres condiciones podríamos hacer probable lo improbable, a saber, la capacidad de resolver la crisis a través de métodos persuasivos. Muchas gracias.
A ver si podemos profundizar un poco, porque desde un punto de vista de la ética, de la justicia, si yo tengo un camión que me suben el tag, efectivamente para mí se me juega la vida, y es una es un tema de un issue, como se diría en inglés. Sin embargo, lo que hemos visto aquí es un tema multifactorial. Entonces, la distinción entre policy y una protesta legítima a mí se me complica un poco, y esta protesta puede tener, y usted insinúa de alguna manera, esta protesta que tiene un componente de legitimidad, por lo tanto avala alguna respuesta persuasiva o no persuasiva, y ahí se nos genera una espiral. Entonces, la pregunta que le hago es si que podemos profundizar un poco más en esta distinción entre una protesta basada en un issue y una protesta que es multifactorial, porque en verdad para mí es muy difícil distinguir, como le digo, un caso concreto del tag. Para mí puede ser lo más justificable que hay de tener una carretera completa, porque en verdad mi vida, mi sustento, mi entorno, el sindicato que yo represento está en jaque, y eso también repercute en la sociedad.
Yes, so thank you for that question. I agree that the distinction between policy-based protest and legitimacy-based protest is on a continuum. To illustrate how one would engage with an issue like that, so let me work with your example you're on a truck, you have a little company, and then there's some regulation being changed, and it might drive you out of business, right? That was the case. So the key to argue that it's a legitimacy-based protest against the government is to work with the criteria that make government legitimate in the first place, that generate a right to rule, and I listed these various criteria there. In a way, a shortcut to all of that is to argue, is this actually something, the measure that the government is taking there, is this questioning your status as an equal participant in society? And if the measure that's being taken on your truck business affects you badly, that by itself would not show that you are not being taken seriously as an equal member of society, assuming there's other things that you can do in society, right? So if this were part of an overall package of measures that would make it impossible for people like you to make a living, then one could argue your status in society is questioned. But as long as there is other ways for you to advance economically, I think that case could not be made. And that, I think, is how one would have to look at scenarios like that. Overall, is it a question where we have policies that affect people negatively? Yes, but upon consideration, we do not want to say that it's undermining their status as equal participants in society. Or is there something stronger going on? And when listening to what the protesters are saying, I think there is so much going on, they are in a way different from your truck example, that they have reason to say getting on in society overall across the board of economic and political possibilities, that is so incredibly much more difficult for people like us than for other people. That would make it a legitimacy-based protest.
Muchas gracias. Y la otra pregunta que algo tocaba Eduardo y Ana María también es en el tema, y me parece muy interesante la respuesta, cuando hay una protesta, una controversia política más transversal que discute la legitimidad, el gobierno debe centrarse en dar respuesta a eso y no tanto a la violencia. La pregunta que yo hago es, ¿dónde está el límite de la respuesta? Que es un punto que insinuó Eduardo. El presidente de la República, en el caso chileno, da una respuesta a los dos días, esta es mi agenda, insuficiente, a los cuatro días, insuficiente, y todavía no sabemos si es suficiente. Entonces, ¿cuál es la tensión ahí entre la expectativa de la legitimidad de la respuesta, de la legitimidad de la protesta y el alcance de las peticiones? Porque obviamente yo quisiera pedirlo todo ahora ya, y dado que estoy parado en una protesta legítima, dénmelo ahora todo ya. Y como usted decía en su mismo PowerPoint, aquí también hay, dentro de las políticas sugeridas, hay equilibrios macroeconómicos después de todo, ¿no? Entonces, la pregunta es, ¿dónde está el alcance de esta capacidad de respuesta? Me parece muy acertada su observación de decir, el gobierno debe centrarse en dar respuesta, perfecto, no solo a la violencia, pero hasta dónde se puede, si es que hay algún criterio para ver hasta dónde se llega esa respuesta, sobre todo en la coyuntura que estamos.
Yeah, another very fair question. So it goes back in a way to the point I was trying in terms of Tocqueville and the French Revolution, right? So you can say that Louis XVI, who was the king in 1789 and paid with his life for this revolution, ended up there precisely because he was driven by Enlightenment era ideals. He gave in to legitimate demands from the population, really very much against the nobility. Took their side, and while he literally lost his head over it in the end, precisely because he thereby also gave the signal to the population, to protesters, you know, they weren't exactly protesters in the today's sense, but, you know, people who want to change, he gave the signal that change was there to be had. It was actually within political agency, and then in a way it's like the spirits that he unleashed, he couldn't rein in anymore, right? And of course that is very much a danger also in the current situation in Chile, that you say, okay, if we are responding to them, no matter the extent to which we respond, we also show protesters that there is space for agency to lead to change. And then, yeah, it may not lead to a balancing of considerations. It may always lead to more protest. I think that is correct. That is an inherent feature of the situation. I think what is needed there is, for one thing, really a very sincere effort of meeting the concerns of the protesters, really not just window dressing, not just something to make people stay home, but a very honest assessment, especially of the privileged groups in this country, to think about the future, to think about the next decades, to think about where the country is going, an honest assessment of that, but then also a very good communication strategy, right? Just to really, to have some people out there who are kind of designated as the faces of that, to communicate that, then to spread also this ideal of deliberative democracy, so that one change is that especially young people are drawn into this more. Is there a guarantee that this will work? No. I think these are the things one can do. But I think it's also pretty clear the only alternative to that is that there is just going to be much more of this anyway. And so you might as well try to embark on the process of reform. And
Muchas gracias. Yo tenía más preguntas, pero lamentablemente estamos en el tiempo. La promesa era terminar a las 11, así que les agradecemos mucho, particularmente al profesor Matías Rice, que ha venido especialmente a Estados Unidos, ha tenido otras entrevistas con autoridades políticas del gobierno, así que le agradecemos también ese tiempo para poder interactuar con el gobierno, con las autoridades de chilenas, así que su aporte es muy valioso. Y por supuesto, a Ana María y a Eduardo por sus tremendos comentarios. El PowerPoint de Matías Rice se va a estar en el sitio web del Centro de Políticas Públicas y los invitamos a un café a la salida de esta sala. Muchas gracias.